Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's a king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
Here we are at another episode. Demetrius, you have finally joined the rankings as being a real pool player. You are a degenerate who's quit their job to make pool your lifelong career. How does it feel to now be an official degenerate pool player?
You know what? I guess I must have always been a degenerate at heart because I feel the same. Just one less hustle I have to be running on the side.
We also have Rob. Hey, Rob.
Hi, fellas. So, here we go again. Hey, a snappy one. We're going to talk about a lot of good stuff today, huh?
Yeah, I suppose if we have to. But Demetrius, you are you're officially joining the ranks, quitting the job and doing coaching full time. So if anybody out there liked what Demetrius had to say in the last few weeks, make sure to head over to mnpoolbootcamp.com and set yourself up with a awesome boot camp with Demetrius and turn your game all around to being the best player you can be.
Thank you. It's been it's been going great. I'll tell you, I'm still going to be working a lot because the training. Trust me. I mean, we're training. You know, we're not training. Somebody asked me the other day. They emailed me because they were asking some questions. They're like, you know, how long do we train? I want to make sure if I come out, I get my money's worth. I'm like, hey, man. I said we go. I said we don't call it a day when the gas light comes on. We go until the car shutters on the side of the road. Like that's what we do. So, yeah. So the point is, I'm still going to be working hard for sure. But it's something that obviously it's energizing to me to do. And I could train pool forever. I mean, the balls will wear down in the marbles before I drop. So it's fun. It's exciting. And so thank you for all those that have contacted me and come out and put that energy into the game. Pool players are where it's at to make the pool world go round. It's that kind of passion.
For sure. And there's been several listeners who have reached out with some general interest in this. And if you ever want to reach out to me to find out a little bit more information, I can always play middleman between you and Demetrius and kind of let you know if your interests and your passions for the game are going to be a good fit with Demetrius. So do not feel hesitant to reach out to me or Demetrius, I'm sure. And if that's ever of interest. So we can move on from that, and we can move into some of the things that I got to get cleared up in the beginning. The YouTube channel that I created for the podcast, it has been a pretty good turnout. I know I haven't done a ton of organizing as far as getting people over there. I created a Facebook post, and a lot of the listeners went over there and did like the channel, and that's awesome. We still need to get a couple more people over there so we can get to the 100. Once we get to 100 people, we can start doing a little bit more stuff. And then from there, we got to, you know, I think the next one is like 1,000 or 500 or something like that. So it's a lot. And that's a lot of that's going to actually be on me. I need to probably get on that a little bit more and get some people over there and get some likes for it. But thank you to everybody who's gone over and subscribed to the YouTube channel. And if you haven't quite yet, please head over there and do that if you would. That would be awesome. Secondly, the Patreon. So the Patreon I created last week, and I had this at the beginning of the episode, and it's had a pretty good reaction. We actually had a couple people go over there and sign up. So thank you to Aaron Taylor, David Peters, Michael Salmon, and Rob Miller. And the last one that just, I'm going to butcher this name. I'm so sorry. You're from Norway. It's awesome that you joined the Patreon. Dag Torbjikson. Hopefully, that's it. Hopefully. If not, sorry. I barely spoke it English. I'm not going to get Norwegian names very well, but sorry. And thank you so much. So depending on whichever level that you signed up for, you have a prize coming. So I will reach out to you individually to find out what you want. And for anybody else who has been waiting to potentially join the Patreon for the podcast, we are going to have a bunch of prizes. I think I'm going to end up giving away at March. I've spoken with Jacoby and McDermott and hopefully a couple others that I'm going to get rounded up very soon. But there will be some really, really good prizes for that we will give away randomly to whoever decides to join the Patreon system. So anybody who wants a couple of those entries for those gifts, depending on the tier that you actually sign up for, will be the amount of entries that you actually get for those raffles, for those prizes, which as I get them knotted down more, I will tell what they are and basically a little bit more details on how to actually win them. But if you've been thinking about joining the Patreon, now is a good time as far as getting yourselves entry into the prizes later on. So then the last thing that I will cover, and I will blow through this super, super quickly, is the updated standings for the magazine for the Moscone Cup. And again, to get any entry into this, you have to just basically go to our page and share the podcast, any of the podcasts that we've had, any of the posts, anything like that. And I will do one special from now on. If you actually share the page to where people can just see the actual page itself, you will get two entries going forward. So if you want to share the page itself, that would be a little bit more efficient way of going. So a couple of people that have joined this weekend was Mike Leonard with 4 entries, Rob Miller with 5 entries, Derek Hagen with 1, Jeff Glaza with 1, and David Peters with 1. So if in the last week, and Alan Davis got 2 and Sean Hanna got 2. So if you've done anything in the last 2 to 3 days and you have not seen your name on here or heard your name, reach out to me and let me know. But other than that, those were the entries for this week. So with that, that's all the things we have to get cleared up in the beginning. We can move on to our shout-outs. Demetrius, would you like to be the first shout-out?
Yeah, I've got a shout-out to my best friend and road partner, Josh Burble. He came over this morning, and not only did he help me install my whiteboard on my wall, which is very helpful, but he gave me this headset because the audio quality on my first few podcasts was pretty rough, and I know that was irritating to the listeners. And so he not only gave me this headset, the thing's like, looks like it's like military grade. It's, you know, combat colors. And of course it's not, it must be probably designed for kids playing some kind of, you know, first person shooter game. But anyway, I kind of feel like a boss now, and I'm hopeful that, that this makes it a more pleasant experience. So thank you, Josh, for your contributions to the Cue It Up podcast.
Your hands free then?
You can, yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to hang on to an actual telephone. While you're on the podcast, you can.
That's right. I'm juggling knives as we speak.
Yeah. You could take pool shots.
Yeah, we'll have to get Josh on some week, I think. I think it'd be a fun addition to the podcast.
For sure.
All right, Rob, do you want to go next?
Oh, the shout out. Sure. Let's go with. I played in a team tournament this last weekend, and there was a team in this tournament, local tournament, Nakusa, Wisconsin, small little city where Jacoby Custom Q is located. And it is their tournament, yearly tournament. There was a team there from Parkersburg, West Virginia. Okay, a 3-man team comes from West Virginia to play in this little tournament. Well, they are Jacoby Custom Q dealers. And the owner of this pool room, it's called the League Room, Billiards and Cafe in Parkersburg, West Virginia, his name is Chris Wilson. And this is the second year, I believe. I saw this team there last year. Didn't get to play them, but we got to play them this year. And I just think that's a, you know, yeah, okay, he's a Jacoby dealer, but that's a long way to come. To play in a, you know, not a huge, you know, $10,000 tournament, but, you know, the winner maybe walked away with $1,500. So that's my shout out to Mr. Chris Wilson.
All right. So I will go next, and my shout-out will actually be to Brandon Jacoby, not only for having the Jacoby Open, but I actually chatted with Brandon over the weekend for a little while, and Brandon is finally a listener to the podcast, he said. He said he's finally – it took him 6, 7, 8 months, whatever it was, to get listening to the podcast, but now he said he's hooked, and he listens every week, and he listens all the time. So shout-out to Brandon for finally making it to the 21st century and figuring out how to use a podcast.
Should I call Brandon and ask him what got him to that point? Maybe there's a trick to it, and that's all I need to know.
That's possible. He kind of mentioned that he didn't really know what a podcast was. He'd never listened to one before. I showed him how to use it at State last year, but he may have forgotten. So who knows?
Yeah. Well, back then you were a nobody.
I still am a nobody, though. Yeah. Well, Rob, now that my self-esteem is down a little bit further, why don't we actually move on to the actual podcast? So we can talk about the conclusion of Justin Bergman and John Mora. And the final score was 100-83. That is including the 15-game spot from the beginning. So with no spot, the conclusion, I guess, is 100-68. A little bit lower than I thought John would have made it to. Did you want to talk about anything from that match, Demi?
Yeah, so first of all, I think I was pretty respectful of John Moore, and I said some good things about him, but I listened to that podcast, and I really feel like John deserves a ton of credit here. The score, people could, like I said, I've already kind of said it, where, this is not, I think to think of this as 10 ball in the sense of it being equivalent to a tournament 10 ball, tournament tables and all that, we kind of covered that, but like, it would just be a big mistake to say, oh, wow, John's, not good for the cash, or John's just not as – he's just not there with the top-ranked players. I think that would be the wrong way to interpret this type of outcome for a couple reasons. One of them is the conditions change this to where I think it's better not even to think about this as a set of 10 ball, but rather to think about it as a set of – rotation one pocket or something like that. I mean, it's just such a, there was very few break and runs. It was just a lot of moving and chipping. So what that does is, the pace of play and the grind level and the fact that it's a money match. And then there's another factor, guys, which is that when you're playing a race to 100 and you realize you're in a bad game and Justin Bergman makes up the handicap and starts getting ahead and he's just making things miserable, does that make you play better or worse? Obviously John was going to be, he's going to be frustrated, irritable, and it's not going to be a fun day at the office. And so the bottom line is that score, the fact that the margin got so big, part of that's the format, and that once you realize you can't win the game, what's your incentive to keep going other than just, hard character and just, because you're a professional and you got to keep giving your best. But the point is that, a lot of players don't like races to 100 for this reason, because the suspense gets out of it. And then they're just kind of day two and day three, we're just kind of playing out, everyone kind of knew the score within the first hour or two, well, with their pace of play, it might've been the first half of the day, but everyone kind of knew what was going on. And so then from there, it's 2.5 days of just kind of slugging along this road to a dead end for John Mora. And so given that, and given the table conditions that made this kind of an abomination of a pool game, and given Justin Bergman's pace of play and how John Mora's just sitting there in his chair hour after hour watching Justin get off shots and, in an inevitable losing match. I mean, that has to be a hell of a hard weekend. And so the point is that you can't really conclude that, oh, Justin plays, that he's going to win 3 out of 5 games against Mora. That's definitely not the conclusion I take here. I say, Mora got into kind of a, he tried it out. He was, I give him, kudos for stepping into a game that he knew was very trappy. He wanted to see if his, if he could outrun that kind of a trap. And so I give him credit for that. But the bottom line is that John is a really top player, and that playing in tournaments, and I'm not saying he can't play for the cash, but playing in tournament conditions and tournament formats where you're playing a set of pool and you're playing on tables that actually break normal, and you can run tables and you can, shoot balls to the corner and catch a little bit of rail and still make balls, and playing under normal conditions, the guy is an absolute monster. I want to give him a ton of credit, ton of respect, and I'm glad he got in the ring. But I just think anybody that looks at these results and takes them too literally is kind of missing the point, which is that, how well John plays over 3 days when he can't win versus how well he plays over 3 days when he knows he has a shot to win are two different things, and similar with the table. So considering the table and how shut out of the match he was, the score being lopsided is just kind of the outcome of that, in my opinion.
See, I got a question for you, Demi. You mentioned a couple of times now the table, the particular table in different conditions. My question is this. You hear guys saying, okay, I have a table at home. Boy, and I really It was tight, but boy, I shimmed it up, and now it's now the pockets are only, you know, 1.75 inches wide or whatever. They're like 9-foot snooker table pockets. And what's your overall feeling about that? Because the pockets at the Derby, I noticed, were not super tight, somewhat forgiving. I saw shots hit the first diamond and still go in the hole, if it was the right speed, on numerous occasions. And I'd just like to know your feeling about that. What is really a good pocket? I never thought shimming things so tight you basically have to hit the center hole or it won't go wasn't really a good thing. That was my personal feeling. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conversation on this, and there's pros and cons. But my general take is, after it all boils down, my bottom line is, I want to play on the same equipment I'm going to compete on. So for me, if I'm going to be playing in pro tournaments and they're going to be using Blue Label, single slate, you know, 4.5 inch with either new cloth or sometimes with worn cloth, then that's what I want to play on. And so the advantage, of course, you know, some people say, well, with tight pockets, you know, you play on tight pockets and then it really forces you to aim at the ball. And then when you go to looser pockets, you feel like King Kong. But the problem is that, first of all, does it actually work that way? Or what it does is you get to the point where you can't beat the 10-ball ghost, or you can't beat whatever ghost you normally beat. And then when you're playing with your sparring partner, you just start playing safeties all the time, because anytime the ball's, you know, on the third diamond and the cue ball's in the middle of the table and you get too thin on it, all of a sudden the percentages dictate that you chip it to the end rail, and then you start playing all these batting balls around. You know, and I realize, like, I've played on tight equipment where, you know, when the 9-ball's on the end rail and the cue ball's up table, you know, you don't even bank that ball, because you just on a tight trap table, it's like that's just so low percentage. And if you bank the 9-ball back up table some which way and leave them long, their make percentage on the ensuing 9-ball shot is lower. So because your bank percentage is low and their make percentage on what you leave them is low, that favors a safety. Whereas if your bank percentage is higher, and if you play safe, their make percentage is also higher, then it shifts things in favor of going for the shot. So what my point is that tight pockets just lead to a lot less offense, a lot less runouts. It leads to a more kind of nitty batting balls around, which I'm fine with. I can do that. Yeah. But what the problem is that when you play like that, so you get this triple shim table and you're like, I'm never going to miss when I go on a normal table. But instead what happens is you get on a normal table and you don't know what the right shots to shoot are. You don't know the percentages. And then the funny part is your confidence with your shot making. You think, oh, I'm used to playing on tight tables. My confidence shooting balls is going to be higher. But if all the time, if you never go for that long bank because you're always ducking there, well, now when you have to shoot a long bank, you're not used to shooting that shot, and you're not used to making that shot. So does that really improve your confidence shooting these shots that you normally duck on? And, you know, if you have to shoot a hard shot where you're cutting a ball down the rail and having to thin it down the rail past the side pocket, if you're used to playing safe there or missing, well, then all you can visualize, even when you get on a looser table, all you can do is visualize how hard that shot is and missing that shot. So what I found is that when people play on big pockets and all they do is visual, and I've seen this happen. So I'll give you an example. I've seen this happen 100 times where players that play strictly on bar tables, they just play on bar tables. And then they go to a big table with tight pockets and all of a sudden they just run the table over. And you think, well, they're coming off a bar table. They're playing on tighter pockets. How could they possibly go to tighter pockets and just run the table over? And the answer is, they're just used to making everything, and every time they look at an angle and look at a pocket, they just visualize the ball going in, because to them, they're used to making all these shots. And so they get up there and they just kind of make everything. And if you're used to playing on shim pockets, you're like, how come they don't slow? How come it doesn't stop? And then eventually they'll hang up a few balls. And at some point you'll see them break down, because then they'll, like, it's almost like a climber looking down. They start to realize how tight the pockets are. And you can see their confidence kind of get destroyed, and then they start melting down. But if you're playing them in one tournament set, they might not melt down until they've got you 6-0 and they haven't missed a ball. So the bottom line is this. There are advantages to practicing on tight equipment. There are advantages to practicing on loose equipment, because the other thing is with tight equipment is if you get out there and you say you're used to playing on tight equipment where nobody runs more than one rack at a time. So all of a sudden you go to loose equipment and you get up there and you run a table and you're feeling like, man, I just did something. And then all of a sudden the other guy, you know, you come up dry on the break, or you leak off a safety, and then the guy runs 2 tables back at you, and you're not used to that level of, you know, you're not used to that level of game flow where there's multiple racks being run and there's people actually like firing in balls, or you, maybe you play a safe and you leave them something that nobody would shoot at on your little trap home table, and all of a sudden the guy just bombs the ball in or shoots in some odd angle combo and runs two racks on you, and then you're like, oh, so there's so many problems. So my advice would be this: practice on tighter equipment once in a while, practice on looser equipment once in a while, so that you get used to, you get some of the advantages of the looser equipment, gives you the advantages of confidence and visualization. The tighter equipment gives you the advantages of really demanding accuracy for your striking. And then, so take the advantages of both, maybe 15% on each, but then 70% of the time, you should be playing on the damn equipment you're going to be competing on, because that's what you're going to be competing on, and there's no shortcut for walking the track of the race you're going to be racing.
I grew up playing on a, well, with regulation size pool balls on a 10-foot snooker table. That was okay for that game, but that really didn't transfer to other games.
Yeah. In an ideal world, it would be nice to have a 9-foot diamond with shim pockets, you know, maybe 4, 4 1/4 or something like that. And then, you know, maybe a 4 3/4 too in your basement or something like that. But it's hard to have that resources and the space to do it. So
we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, that's real interesting, though, Demetrius, about the different psychological aspects in playing with or practicing on certain types of equipment, and then playing on different types of equipment, and how that really can affect you.
There's something else that I think is really funny, and don't worry, Nate, I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole too deep, but I'll just hint at something. One of the things I find the funniest is that oftentimes pool players hatch this plan, or they come up with like a kind of a one-dimensional, out of balance, just kind of a one idea that spawns in their mind. And they're like, well, if I get on a tight table and then I practice on that, then I'll never miss a ball. And then that's just, and so they come up with this theory. They concoct this plan. They hatch this plan. And then they never go back and ask themselves. They never evaluate. It's like a hypothesis that they just assume is real. They never test it. They never evaluate it. So like 5 years go by and maybe their game is all out of kilter and it's not actually working. And they're still, you know, all these different problems that can come with playing on a tight table only. And they never go back and revisit. Was that strategy a good one? How did that actually work? You know, there's one of my favorite quotes is, there is no difference between theory and practice. In theory, but there isn't practice. And so it's like you come up with this theory, but then you got to ask yourself, how is it actually working out? And if it's not working out the way then you got to reevaluate and say, hey, it's a great idea. Tight pocket sounded good, but in practice, it's not doing the way I wanted it to do it. So maybe I should be open to the idea that, you know, and I could give some very, very funny examples of people that come up with an idea of how they think that they're going to get better, or how they think that the game is going to work, or what their plan is. And they just hatch this little idea and they think they're so clever, and then they run themselves into the ground and they don't get the results they want. And they never once, they cling to that and just die on that hill. And it's like, yeah, you die on that hill then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, going back to the match itself, you had kind of mentioned this, and, I don't know. So I watched day one and day two basically from start to finish. Day two was a little bit, it was kind of already decided at that point who was going to win. It was kind of just a matter of time. I don't want to sound like I'm disrespecting John. And I think this was a really hard game for him, not necessarily because he was outclassed on the table, because I don't necessarily think that as much. But I think it's really hard to play against Justin Bergman. When he's down on a shot, and this is going to kind of go to what my broader picture is, I don't know how many more matches like this I can watch. I mean, as a fan of the game, I watch these things all the time. I watch a lot of these matchups, and I just don't know how much I can take a player getting up and down on a shot 2-3 times on something that seems to be as routine as a stop shot, or maybe even like a 4 or 5 inch draw. Justin Bergman is really hard to watch as a fan of the game, and that's even harder to play against, especially somebody like me who's predominantly a rhythm player. I like to, you know, keep at the table. I like to just kind of float around the table, hit balls, and not really take too much time analyzing tables. that's really hard to play against if you're playing against somebody who takes, you know, 35 to 55 seconds per shot, regardless on the shot. So as a fan of the game, this is a little tough to watch.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And there's been a lot of talk. I mean, you know, in the end, it's kind of like who's driving the bus here. I mean, because is this a money match that John and Justin wanted to play, and this is what they wanted to do and how they wanted to work it out, and they're both totally fine with the environment, and then a third party is just like, hey, this is a good game going down, we want to capture it on film, and they're like, yeah, you do you, whatever, if you want to film it, that's fine. Like, if that's the deal, I mean, of course, you know, people can do what they want to do, but if any part of this was designed towards, you know, in viewership and engaging an audience, then at some point you have to say, you know, are like, if it's just them playing a game on their own, they can do what they want. But if this is supposed to be a product that we bring to market, then that product is definitely got some recalls. and so that's it. And so there's a lot of ways to solve it. I mean, trust me, on the AZ Billiard forums, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, different ways to solve that. But in the end, I mean, there's a few ways to solve that. As a person that's going to be doing streams and trying to do pay-per-view and try to get audience, you could either say, you know, you could either introduce a shot clock and a ref, or you could say, we want to pick players that are going to draw an audience.
Oh, yeah. Because we want Earl Strickland and Jason Cha head-to-head.
Yeah, because guess what? You know, if players had an incentive, you got to look at it, and everything's about incentives. You know, if players were being passed over and somebody was like, hey, you know what, I could get a free roll on with an appearance fee and a percentage of pay-per-view drop and all this stuff. And I could get a free roll to play a challenge match basically and have a chance to win a lot of money or even just win a little money, even if I lose because I've got backers or I'm getting a percentage of the pay-per-view. But the requirement of that is kind of like the Moscone Cup's a free roll, right? The Moscone Cup is a great free roll. The losing team gets paid. The winning team gets paid more. They get recognition. They can, you know, increase their appeal to sponsors. All that's great. But what do you have to do? You have to play good. You have to play in the right tournaments to qualify and get points and get visibility. And you have to demonstrate a high level of play. Well, the same thing with the streams. If the streams were like the Moscone Cup, where players wanted and coveted the opportunity to play challenge matches because of financial reasons and notoriety reasons and just for the fun and enjoyment of it. But then if they knew that, hey, I got passed over this time because they told me like my last time I got so much negative feedback about my pace of play or my, you know, the way I played that people don't want to watch, then all of a sudden it creates an incentive for players to start actually changing their behavior. Because right now, if there's no incentive, then the only incentive is to get the job done and win. And so you can't fault Justin Bergman for doing what's going to get the job done. You could actually, I don't blame you know, people that blame Justin. It's like, no, Justin's there to win the money. You've got to blame the people to create the incentives, because if there's no incentive for him to play faster and there's no incentive, you know, where he's going to get passed over on future opportunities or he's going to, you know, whatever, like if there's no incentives in play, then who's the people that are setting up? Who are the people follow the money? Who are the people just determining how the money flows and how that stuff goes? And if you're not incentivizing entertaining play, then you're asking for this. And I hold the promoters and the people that set up the format completely responsible. And so in the end, it's kind of like if you're a musician, you know, it's not just about making good music. It's about, you know, having a producer and making the right connections. And you have to, at the same time, think about what the audience wants. And at some point, it's not just you just play pool and if you're good, you're good. It goes beyond that. You have to. So anyway, I've said what I wanted to say. It's about incentives. I hold the promoters responsible if this was actually like a promoted match.
Yeah. And Justin Bergman he's a treat to watch. I mean, he's such a talent on the pool table. I love to be able to watch him. It's just, man, just it's the getting up and getting down on a shot. It's like he gets down.
Well, then he plays in the Moscone Cup with a 30-second time clock and does just fine, you know?
Yeah. So this is, it's definitely a manufactured thing. He doesn't have to play that way. Anyway.
You know, if you're playing somebody like that and you're ahead of them, it merely just a little irritating that they're playing so slow and doing that kind of antics. But if you're behind, oh my goodness, it is pure torture.
So we can move on to the next event, which was the Cajun Coast event, which was held in Louisiana. and this had a bit of a 2003 throwback with Johnny Archer getting first place over Shane
Scorpion. Congratulations, yeah. Scorpion.
Over Shane McMahon, and James Aranis gets third place. Fourth place goes to Sergio Rivas. Fifth, sixth goes to Josh Roberts and John Salim. Seventh, eighth goes to Warren Kiamko and Jason LaFleur. And we'll go back one more spot because Francisco Bustamante is in 9th through 12th. So the rest of them is Dallas Bronsard, Josh Hillard, and Larry Labave. We'll go with Labave. So kind of nice to get a little throwback to see Johnny Archer in there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I want to come back to Archer. I actually want to talk a little bit about him. And but by the way, I mean, shout out to Shane McMahon and also to Sergio Rivas. Those are, for Aranis taking third, so Sergio taking fourth. I'm not selling him short. I've played him. I've seen him play recently, and he's really coming on strong as a heck of a player. But Shane McMahon getting to the finals in that field, that's a really good form. I saw Shane. I was actually in Olathe back, I think, in November. They have the Midwest Nine Ball Tour Bar Table Championship, and then One Pocket. He won both events. He won the One Pocket. He won the Nine Ball. And the One Pocket, he actually got me in the finals. But he played really, really well. And then the Nine Ball, I mean, 100 some players, Bar Table Nine Ball. And that had, a lot of, we're not talking about that tournament. I'll just say it had a lot of good players. He, for him to win both events shows that he's playing very, very well. And for him to reach the finals of this tournament. And you probably don't know. Who beat Aranis on the B side?
James Aranis lost to Johnny Archer for the chair, and then Shane McMahon beat him on the B side.
That's a heck of a match, man. That Aranis. I mean, well, either way, that's good job, McMahon, getting to the finals and beating Aranis and all the other players he beat on the way. He's hitting them very well. And then moving back to the Scorpion, though, huh? What do you guys think?
I did have a comment about Archer.
Yeah.
Since he's more from my era. But, I'm not surprised at all that he can go out there and win a tournament. Some of the other tournaments in the last 10 years that he's played, he's done well. Hasn't won them, but he's competed in them. Yeah, and he owns a pool, I believe, right? And so it's not like the guy isn't playing some pool once in a while. And I did see him play not too long ago on a Facebook feed from Justin Volk, the inventor of a pool game called Lifesaver. And he was in a pool hall, and he drives a truck for a living, and he was in Johnny's pool hall is, South Carolina, I think, maybe. And he was in his pool hall, and he introduced Johnny to his game of Lifesaver. And they were playing it, I believe, on a 7-foot diamond. And he videotaped it, and so that their match that they had on that was Justin Volk and Johnny Archer playing. So I have seen him play recently, and he actually did very well in the game, played the game great.
I'm curious to find out. I'll have to talk to you offline and get more. About the Lifesaver. But hey, so with Johnny Archer, so let me ask you guys a question. Of course, it's no secret that he's not at his absolute peak. The highlights of his career are probably behind him in terms of his best years or whatever player of the decade. Wasn't he in the 90s? Multiple time world championship. So here's the question, though. When you see him have a flashback and win a tournament like this, it's obvious that he still has the capabilities. So the question is, we all know, like, if you look at the top players in the world, so many of them are Elvin Oceans and Clenty Kajis and Fedor Gorce and Josh Fillers and all these young, 18 to 23-year-old champions, Koping Chung, So when we think about, like, the knowledge and the experience that the players gain, pool can be played well into your late chapters of life. So what is it that stops Johnny Archer, or what is it that stops any player that gets a little bit later in their life from keeping up with what they did when they were younger? Like,
it's the demand on you mentally, probably number one. And physically, sure, for sure. Like Johnny Schmidt said, how hard it was to run all those balls. Mm. He had to start eating right and sleeping right and doing all kinds of other things. So it's got something to do with that.
So it's just physically energy wear down,
but mentally worse. It's harder. When I was younger, it was much easier to perform at a high level under high stress conditions. And now it really, you start breaking down sooner the older you get mentally.
You made me think of something. So one of the things that's my biggest opponent, my most difficult opponent, can be fatigue. Because when I play tournaments, I mentioned that Olathe tournament, I was playing until 4 or 5 in the morning a few nights, and then I had to get back there and play at 10 or 11. And day after day after day, that was going on. And then because I was still in the one pocket and the nine ball, I didn't really get many breaks because I was playing match after match after match. And so I know that when I get really, really tired, that the game, my game, it could just break down. It could break down in ways that are just discouraging and frustrating and difficult to navigate through. And so fatigue has been a big challenge, especially in formats. At the pro tournaments where they schedule the matches out and you usually have a little time, then it's not really the same adversary. But in these kind of regional events where you're playing until dawn, you know what I mean? It's like those, it's fatigue has been a big challenge. So I wonder, is what you're saying is like, if Johnny Archer competing in these tournaments, it's almost like when I'm struggling because of fatigue, it's almost like he's like that all the time. Is that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's
who knows? A lot of things probably in this particular tournament went his way. You can run into players that you're probably going to lose to, but you beat because they just were a little unlucky or a little off that game, or they were thinking about their kids, or I don't know, whatever it is. I mean, you don't have to be at your top every time. And in a tournament, you may miss those players at all. The two hottest players may play each other. You may not see them again or whatever, depending on the type of format it is in the tournament. But, that kind of thing happens. I see that happening a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great, great performance. And it's always nice to see. And it's inspiring to know, I'm not sure exactly how old Johnny is, but I'm guessing that he's, do you think in his 50s? Is that fair?
Yeah.
So it's really
how
exciting.
Old is Earl?
Yeah, I'm not 100%.
Right?
I mean, we can look it up, but that's not the point. The point is that it's inspiring. Of course, this was not the U.S. Open. This was not the World Championship. I mean, I get it.
Johnny Archer is 51 years old.
It sounds like he played a regional field with some top regional players and a couple of world-class players, and he got there, and he won the key badges that he needed to win. So I understand he didn't win, the World Championship, but it is still fun to see his name at the top of the board, and it's inspiring to know for anybody that's not exactly 22 years old, it's inspiring to know that you can still play you can still have a heck of a career if you keep getting in the ring and trying your hardest.
Yeah,
we can move on from there now. And there was a big event in Europe, and this was one of the Moscone Cup actual qualifiers, so we'll cover this really quickly. First place actually goes to Eklanti Kaci. And now I feel like my comment last week that Eklanti Kaci was actually in the top tier of players, I feel like I'm smarter now.
He was ranked number one on the Euro Tour for plenty of time.
Yeah.
There's no question that he's a dominant European player. The question is, was he ranked along sides of Dennis, Shane, Shaw, Filler? And I would say he's not. I would say there's a group of five guys or six guys that are considered pre-tournament favorites in any international field. And those guys are Filler, Shane, Wu, who else did I say? Shaw, Dennis,
the Coe brothers, I think are probably in there too. They're stupid good.
Yeah. My daughter wants to give them a nickname, by the way. We were talking about a nickname for those guys, and she wants to call them the Cobras. I'm trying to get that, see if that sticks.
That's kind of funny, anyway, though.
But anyway, the point is that we know that Filler, there's a tier that's right behind those five guys, and that tier includes Fedor Gorst, it includes Alex Pagulin, it includes Klenti Kaci, it includes, Elvin Ocean, it includes, Alex Kazakis, all these other guys. And so I think it's, Klenti got ranked number one in Europe. You don't do that on the Euro Tour. Like, you don't do that without being a threat to win. I mean, for sure, he's a threat to win any event he enters, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So third place, third, fourth goes to Conrad, and the second week in a row I have to pronounce Conrad's last name, and I think I went better this week. I think I got a little bit closer this week, but he shares third place with Niels Fein. Fifth through eighth goes to Jason Shaw, Fedor Gorst, Miesko Forchunski, and Max Leshner. So we will leave that one there, and we will talk about the last event, which is it was held at Hard Times Billiards in Sacramento, which is Oscar Dominguez's room. And to be honest, the most of the brackets were on paper, so it's really, really hard to actually get to see them, and I was not able to get all of them. So we know that John Schmidt, Mr. 600, wins the one pocket and the nine ball, which is, I mean, we can talk about this very briefly. How hard is it to win a nine ball event and a one pocket event? I mean, those are probably the two most polar opposite games in the game of the pocket billiards itself. And the fact that John is able to win them both really shows how well-rounded his game actually is.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually pretty good. Now, I don't know. I guess the question is, who was in the field? Like, who did he play in the finals, or do we know anything about his opponents? Listen, I mean, Hard Times, obviously, I would assume Oscar was playing, but you never know. He might have been running his room.
Oscar lost to him in the nine ball finals.
Okay.
And there was a lot of top players. There was just a bunch of actually really top players in that field.
Yeah. The other thing that's kind of nice is that, you know, everyone was kind of like, well, not everybody, but people were bringing up the fact that he set that 626 on pretty big pockets. And, you know, now he goes to Hard Times, where we all know that Hard Times, they're notoriously difficult tables. And so for him to go play Oscar, his, you know, rotation on his home tables that are all very tight and get to the finals of both fields, that shows just, I mean, what does it show? It shows obviously that he knows all games. It shows that he can play in all equipment. It shows that he has a ton of heart and a ton of fight. And you know, people were giving John a hard time about making us run during an exhibition or, you know, as a, you know, without an audience or without an opponent. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, he's a fighter, man. He's not a ballet dancer. He's a street fighter. And that guy demonstrates the true mastery of all skills, formally and physical. And wow, what a finish. Good job, Mr. Schmidt.
Yeah, for sure. So we're already running a little bit long, and I know Demetrius has to get going pretty quickly, so we won't talk too in-depth about this one, but we will move on to the end of the podcast so we can get Demetrius out of here, so we can go quit his job officially.
That's right.
So we'll do a quick discussion topic, and I think we'll do this discussion topic because Demetrius and I had a phone conversation a couple days ago, and man, was he fired up about this topic. So we will talk with Demetrius and myself and Rob a little bit about breaking plateaus and constantly evolving in the game of pool so that you're not spending large amounts of time in a stagnant state of your basically your pool game. So you're not going 10, 15, 20 years without actually making strides and getting better. So Demetrius, you were pretty fired up about this. Why don't you take it away to start out with?
Yeah, I'll tell you what was on my mind. And I think that, you know, breaking plateaus is kind of like my overall. I don't like the idea of being stagnant. I don't like getting to the point in your game where years and years and years are passing by and you're just kind of not making visible breakthroughs and progress and achieving things that you haven't achieved before. Like if your straight pool run isn't going up year after year, it's like, you know, those are the things that matter to me. And so that there's a lot of different things that roll up into that. But what I wanted to talk about was I made a post on AZ Billiards and it didn't really spark a lot of conversation. And it kind of irritated me because people are making posts about, I love AZ Billiards, man, but people are making posts about the same things again and again. So what I was saying is that when you want to get better at pool, the path to improvement leads off the pool table. And so my premise is this: when you begin at pool, you can just put in hours on the pool table. And basically, regardless of how you put in hours on the pool table, you will get better. So when you're just learning to bridge and you're just learning to hit below center and you're just learning to pocket balls, if you put in hours on the pool table, you will improve. You know, whoever, if you go to your local pool room, whoever you play is going to have something that you're going to learn from, and they're going to show you things and you're going to pick things up, and just day by day, you're going to get better. Regardless of what you do, you're just going to show up, you're going to put in time, you're going to get better. Show up, put in time, and get better. And the trap is that that continues for years, where you just show up and play and you just keep getting better, and you show up and you play and you keep getting better. And so what happens is people learn the wrong thing. People conclude that they are on this path, and that path will just keep, it'll keep going. So if there's a learning curve to pool, you could almost say that the arc, it starts off very, very quick growth, and then it continues, and the growth tapers off and tapers off and tapers off. And that steep uphill, you know, where in the beginning it was rapid growth, rapid growth, rapid growth, but then it starts to like level off. But when people see that level, that, that rapid growth, rapid growth, rapid growth, they make a faulty extrapolation of that graph, and they say, well, geez, I'm getting better every day, and I'm just playing pool, and I keep getting better. I'll just do this a few more years, and I'll be the best in the world. It's one of those erroneous conclusions that people never revisit. And the fact is that no, what happens is they're picking up low-hanging fruit. And so when you're picking apples out of a tree, you don't need a ladder if all you want to do is pick the ones on the ground or the ones in the low branches. But at some point, you got to get a ladder if you want to get the high-hanging fruit. You can't just extrapolate. And these people that think they're just going to keep putting in time and they're just going to keep getting better, that's fine. But at what point, how many years have to go by without change before you revisit that conclusion? Right? This is my point. And this is why I get fired up, because here's why. Because somebody came over to my house last week and wanted to play me some pool. I'm like, yep, I had a little time for once. I didn't want to blow them off. So we got together. We played. This person hasn't gotten better at pool in over 5 years. And they work Monday through Friday. They play on the weekends. And what they do is they go and they go to this place. I won't name names or places, but they go or they play in the same place. They play the same level of players. And then they do the same practice and nothing changes. And I'm just like, so I talk to him and I'm like, hey, you know, because I kind of feel bad, man. And the reason I get so fired up, it's not for me. I'm doing just fine. Okay. I'm getting better. I've had amazing results. I've had amazing breakthroughs in the game. New things that I'm doing on the pool table that I've never been able to do before. I just set my high run and number of break and runs playing 10 ball. Like I keep breaking through to new stuff and new levels, and I'm excited about it. And I just want other people to have that. Like, how come we all can't have that? And the answer is because, like, you know, so I'm asking him, and it's just, and so I told him, I said, hey, you don't have to be at the same level. Like, if you haven't improved for 5 years, like, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, the next 10 years don't have to just be you working your job Monday through Friday so that you can live for the weekends when you get to play pool. And then you show up and just kind of saw wood and go through these motions and let the days pass and look at people on videos and wonder, you know, man, it would be cool if I got to be the guy where I got to get better and play good and have some amazing experiences. But oh well, I guess it's just not in the cards for me. I wasn't given that talent. I guess I just am not talented enough, or I'm unlucky. And then they go back and I'll just kind of bang balls around the table and let the time pass. And that's fine. I mean, you know, it's, everybody enjoys their life and everybody enjoys the game. But like I told him, I said, it doesn't have to be that way. And he says, well, and so here was his excuse. It's hard to find good players to play. That's what he told me. And I'm like, okay, that's fair. That's a challenge. So you have a choice. You have a fork in the road. You could either take that challenge on and overcome it, or you can resign. And so I guess the way I see pool, and the reason I said that the game takes you outside of the four rails, is because that becomes part of the game. So we know that when we play pool, there's challenges. Sometimes there's difficult shots. Sometimes there's difficult bridges. You're over a ball. Sometimes you're hooked. You have to jump a ball or play off a rail or bank a ball. These are challenges, right? When you play pool, you say, I am going to test myself against a set of challenges. But the problem that people make is that they assume that the challenges of pool should all stay within those four rails. They should all be on that table. Whereas in my world, that's true when you're a beginner. Like I said, that's true for the first few years. But at a certain point, you have to change your understanding of what it means to compete at pool and what it means to what pool really is. And so pool is just not just the challenges on the table. It's the challenges off the table. So for him, if finding a competitor that's going to push him and help teach him and help push him to a new level, if that's a challenge, anything between him and his goal of growth, if he has a goal, maybe he doesn't even have a goal, certainly can't hit a goal if it doesn't exist. But if you have a goal of getting better, then anything that stands between you and that goal becomes part of pool. So it's like, for him, for example, it's like, well, what are you trying to get better at? Well, I need to work on my long shots, and I need to work on my bridges off a rail, and I need to work on finding competitors that can push me. And actually finding competitors that can push him is at the top of the list. And that has nothing to do with anything on the pool table, but yet that's probably the most important thing he has to do. You know, he could put in 1,000 hours practicing off a rail. It's not going to do as much good as spending 1 hour introducing himself to people at a pool hall and seeing if anybody has any interest in playing with him. You know, so I'm kind of on a rant, but I'm going to keep going because I don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to spit it out and you get to the heart of it. The example I gave you as another analogy is, for me, I don't get to go play every pro tournament. They're expensive. I'm not competitive at the international level, and I can't always take a week to go play. So what I need to do for me to keep getting better is I need to play regional competition. I need to be able to play fields like we just talked about with this Cajun Open and the Hard Times Tournament, like fields like that. And they have them around. I mean, they have them in Beloit. They have them in Des Moines once in a while, or Fargo. But my problem is I'm not a big social media guy, so I don't always find out. Like, that's how people find out about tournaments. So oftentimes I will be, you know, kind of like, man, I haven't played a competition for a while. I sure wish there was something in my area. And then all of a sudden I'll see something on AZ Billiards about how there's a tournament in Des Moines and all these pro players are playing. And I'm like, man, that was in my backyard. How come I didn't know about that? And so it occurred to me that if I want to get better, I need more competition and I need to learn about these tournaments. And so if I'm not on social media, if I have a coach, if I'm like, hey coach, what do I need to get better? What should I practice? They're going to say, put your damn cue down, go out of your pool room, go online, create a social media account, learn how to use it, and find out about these tournaments. Because if I spent 1 hour a week learning about, or even 20 minutes a week, I mean, if I spent an hour a month finding out about pool tournaments that I could go play and compete against, maybe I find a chance to play an extra tournament every couple months. Maybe I can play an extra 4 tournaments a year against top-level players. And then those experiences and those competitions are going to do far more for me than dumping an extra hour into doing the same stuff I've been doing for the last 20 years. And so the point is that for me, finding out about tournaments is a challenge. And so that becomes part of the pool game. The pool game is not on the table. The pool game is anything between you and your pool goals. And once you understand that and you shift your mindset to, I am accountable for my career, I am accountable for my whole journey, and that I need to understand how much resource I have, what I need, who I need to be playing, what vitamins I need, you know, from the different, how much needs to be competition, how much needs to be practice, are leagues beneficial, should I be playing in different types of tournaments, where, how should I set this up, and what's holding me back? The challenges we face are not just on the table. And at some point, you have to accept that, make that part of the game, take it on. The answers for each of us are different because it depends on what's holding you back. But that is absolutely one of the biggest leaks I see is that people have never outgrown this attitude that they're just going to show up with their cue together. And they just think that they're just going to put their cue together and play, and it's all just going to come together for them. And what I was talking about being an artist earlier, or a musician, like if you're a musician and you just play in your basement and you make great music, like, do you think that the studios are just going to hear you from outside? You know, they're going to be passing by with their windows down and they're going to hear some amazing riff come out of somebody's basement and knock on the door, and that the world's just going to come to your door and say, hey, we want to make you a star. Like, no, you have to network. You have to meet people. You have to get your music out there. Like, career management. I mean, if you want to be a superstar musician, half of it is being great at music, but the other half is about being able to manage a career. And pool at some point is no different. You know, you've got to put in time at the table, but then you've got to manage your career. All right. That's it, man. It was burning me up because to see somebody not get better for over 5 years and fritter away endless hours kind of with kind of a disappointed shoulder shrug, that fires me up. So that's why.
Well, that's a pretty good point. You have to manage your life in regard to how it affects –
your pool playing sometimes, what your priorities in life. You know, you want to work it all in together so that you can get better at everything in your life at the same time you're getting better at pool. Sometimes it's putting up a slab outside and putting a roof and sidewalls on it and sticking a pool table in it and a portable heater out there. You know, I mean, it's, yeah, your point is well taken. It's life and pool is a mixture. And if you want to get better at it all, you gotta focus on more than one thing at a time sometimes.
And part of the game, you know, if you have a job and you have a family and you have, you know, you have other things that are interfering, then part of the game is, you know, drawing boundaries and maybe, and it's trying to figure out how much time you do have to work with. And then managing a career is actually part of your pool game.
You need to have what I call is the talk. If you're married, I had the talk, I call it, with my wife at about 4 to 5 years. The talk didn't just happen overnight. It was like little pieces at a time.
Okay.
Until in the end, it was the talk, and to kind of get her to understand the personal involvement in my life that pool was, and where it came in the mix between marriage and kids and work and, you know, profession and all that kind of stuff. When she really didn't have that idea, like it isn't like knitting, okay? It isn't like, you know, putting puzzles together in the living room for something to do. This is truly a passion, and you need to have that talk, especially if your wife's not a pool player or a competitor.
And
you know?
That's exactly right. And the thing about it is that it's not all or nothing. So you could say, well, I'm married, so I can't just play full time like all these guys that are single. So therefore, I'll just do nothing.
Oh, no.
That's
right.
My excuse. Because you kind of have three options. Okay. You can go all in and say, I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have a family. I'm never going to work.
Bad option.
Okay. So we know that.
Yeah.
You have another option where you can say, well, since I'm not all in, I guess I can't do anything because I just don't have the opportunity. Or you can say, hey, I know I can't go all in, but here's what I've got. What are the things holding me back? What are my responsibilities? What are my energy? And so I talk about using your resources and being strategic and budgeting, but understanding that a lot of that, if you set your life up to where you understand what you have for time and energy and money to put into the game, and then you there's a saying that if you have an hour to chop down a tree, then you should spend 50 minutes sharpening the axe. And I think that applies here.
Yeah.
And it's like, look,
you
want to chop down, you want to get better at pool. You've got a certain amount of time and energy. Why don't you take a little bit of time, understand what the things are in your life that are actually stopping you from advancing at pool. And then you can't solve them in the sense that, like, if you're married, yeah, to your point, you can't just be like, well, I'm going to solve that by just not caring about my marriage. Like, that's not the answer. But the answer is to say, what can I do? How much can I put in? What is a reasonable balance? And on the night that I am going to play, what are the right times? What's the right way for me to put in into my game so that I both enjoy myself and continue to grow?
Yeah.
That's all. And I just think that it's just, you got to manage your career, man. You just got to manage your career. That's
the other thing that helps, that I found that helps, is on occasion when you walk in the door after a weekend or a half a week or a week playing pool, you sit down at the table and she welcomes you home, and you lay like $7, $8, $9, $10, $12, $100 bills in front of her and say, this is your cut. that seems to do wonders for the next time if you'd like to go play in a tournament somewhere.
The only problem with that is that then you then at the end of that little conversation, you don't have that $1,200 anymore. That's the only problem.
No, right. But that's only half of what you won. So you have the other 12. I always make sure of that she doesn't get it all. She just gets half.
Hey, guys, I have to run. I'm going to bail. If you guys, thanks for letting me share that, Nate. I'm glad. And then podcast viewers, thanks for listening. Do your best. Enjoy this game and do your best at it, because you only get one life.
You know what? Podcast listeners, I would get a hold of Demetrius and think about this boot camp that he's doing.
Well,
sounds like you'd learn a lot more about pool than just pool.
Thank you, Rob. Hey, you're going to learn about anything between you and where you want to go.
Rob and I will finish up here. And all right, Rob, just us now. We will finish this up with the two tips. So do you want to go first?
You know, this is going to be really, really easy. I'm going to talk about tips. We're going to take a pool tip. I just put two of the cheapest pool tips you can buy on my sticks. And yeah, do they mushroom out a little bit? Do they lose their shape a little? Yeah, whatever. You can just fix that as you go. But I've never been so happy. Even though I did jump over a ball, giving it low this weekend, and it was down the rail shot. I'm trying to drive back up the table, and I went directly over the top of the ball into the corner pocket swish. But that was me. That wasn't the tip.
Well,
that's my tip.
I'm going to have to
Do you want to know the name of the tips?
Seems like you should.
Elkmaster.
Well, I don't disagree with you too often, but I will disagree there because I don't actually like Elkmaster tips or LePro tips. But that's just
me. No, LePro is no.
Yeah.
They're okay, but no.
Yep. So my tip will be, and I've said this before, but the people that I've been working with recently with the University of Wisconsin pool team, it seems like no matter how many times I say it, they still like to get jumpy. So if you are not still in your stance when the ball falls in the pocket, you are standing up too fast. So make sure to watch the ball fall in the hole. If you're out of your stance before that happens, you are jumping out of your stance way too quickly, and bad things are going to happen over the long run. So make sure you're still in your stance when the ball falls in the hole. Watch the ball fall in the hole.
I will assert that is true, and I want to push the envelope a little bit there and say to a person who might be listening or not that if he is, Ziggy, did you hear what he just said?
Ziggy likes to watch the ball fall in the hole from through the ceiling because I think every time he shoots a ball, his head literally goes through the rafters. Well, even Randy Lamar. I mean, Randy Lamar and Ziggy, they are the man. Their head is no ceiling tile safe with those two shooting in a room together.
Randy does stay down a little bit longer though, and he jumps up after the balls start rolling because he's trying to work them to where they need to go.
Yeah.
And we know that makes a difference, right? That,
yeah.
Where that ball's going to roll. It's kind of help your body, kind of pushes it over there a little bit.
Yep. So we can move on from that. And I will give a shout out to a sponsor this week, which will be the IQ ball. And I use this IQ ball for practicing with the college students that I work with when I'm coaching at the University of Wisconsin. So when people say like you need two tips of low, people don't realize that your mind actually stops your body actually usually from getting two tips. You only get about a tip and a half if you're lucky. So the IQ ball, it really, really helps to know exactly where you're striking the cue ball so that you can actually see if you're getting two tips of low English when you're actually, you know, shooting a shot that you think is two tips. So, yes, the IQ ball, it definitely helps you with figuring out exactly where you're hitting on the cue ball. It's a super cheap investment, and I do advise getting it, you know, if you really want to just solidify your ball striking on the cue ball, because that's where the game kind of starts and stops at a high level. So, I will give a shout out to the IQ ball this week. And with that, Rob, we can close it out for another week.
Okay, boy, it's been great. Demi sure helped us a lot today. I want to thank him.
Yep.
And all the listeners out there in pool land, thanks for listening.
Yep, for sure. All right. See you later, Rob.
Okay, Nate, bye.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Cue Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindham for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T.